This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Kelly Anissa. In 2015, world leaders agreed to 17 goals for a better world by 2030. Access to clean water and sanitation is the sixth goal on that list due to the impact it can have on access to education, the economy, women and children. Joining me today is Dr. Tay Soo Tai, CEO of the Global Peace Foundation Malaysia, to discuss about one of their flagship programs, Communities Unite for Pure Water, or better known as CUP, and their work in providing access to clean water to rural communities. Welcome to the show, Dr. Tay.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me. So just before we start things, tell me a little bit about CUP.
So the Communities Unite for Pure Water is an initiative of the Global Peace Foundation Malaysia. And when one of my colleagues told me years ago that there are still pockets of communities in the rural area, predominantly Orang Asli communities, that still do not have access to clean and safe drinking water, I did not really believe him. Until he brought me to those communities and for me to see the type of water they're drinking from the ground and the distance for them to get access to water. That was when we decided that we have to do something, because this is a serious issue affecting the community's health and children as well. So that's how we kickstarted the program.
So how many projects has CUP worked on so far? It started in 2000 and...
Yeah, it got started in 2014. Yeah, and since then we have worked in various communities in both East and West Malaysia. And so far we have covered about 35 communities or villages, benefiting hundreds of families in those villages.
All right. So one of your initiatives include WASH training, and that is a collaboration with Westergaard. So what was that initiative about? What is WASH training?
Yeah. So the issue with lack of access to clean water is closely connected with personal hygiene and sanitation. And when a community do not get access to clean water or water is very scarce, they tend to ignore personal hygienes, because when you don't have water, enough water, you would just use them for drinking, cooking, and probably shower. So the practices of you know, hand washing, brushing teeth, is very rare, and we also observe a lot of skin infections among children, especially, and even adults, because of poor personal hygiene. So because of those observations, we realized that besides providing them with better access to water, water filtration system to have access to clean and safe drinking water, we need to provide training. We need to remind them of practices of you know, hand washing after toilet, before food, after playing with the soil, especially those kids, toothbrushing, and how to protect their water source and so on. So there's a series of modules that we develop to help raise awareness of a healthier lifestyle.
Yeah. Right. So walk me through the process your team takes. How do you come across these communities? Do they reach out to you or?
Yeah. So when we first met the first Orang Asli communities, it was because a friend of us, you know, informed us as it's this village that they're struggling with the issue of water. That's how we went into the village and start talking to them, understanding their challenges. I mean, a lot of these communities are connected. We predominantly work in area in Pahang, around district of Chini and also Muazzam Shah, and as well as a region around Gopeng. So a lot of these Orang Asli communities, they are connected to other villages because of their relatives and friends. So a village that we have worked with to provide them with clean water would then recommend us that they have relatives in other villages that would need our assistance. That's how we expand to other villages as well.
Right. So how long does your team spend on each village or area that you go to? And, you know, what do you do once you get there? Like the process, do you start speaking to the villagers? Do you speak to the local council?
Yeah. So we do develop a process. After a while, we realize that it's important to do it properly. So usually the first few visits, we'll be talking to the head of the village. Mm-hmm. Either they have a tobatin, they call them,
right,
or just someone elder or senior in a village if they don't have a tobatin. And our purpose is really, really to get to know them, as well as introducing ourselves to them. Building trust and relationship, we realize, is a very important key to mm-hmm. a success of any community
right.
program. Because some of these villages have better experience before, whether with other NGOs or maybe government. So mm-hmm. so we want to establish that trust, that we are here with a very clear agenda. We heard that you've got challenges on drinking water, and we're here to find out more. And a lot of them are willing to tell us. They will show us. They bring us to the source of water, whether it's a self-dug well, whether it's a pool, you know, a pond that they get water, and so on. And we would start studying their water source. We'll collect water sample. We'll take picture of the water source. We'll measure the distance, how far, you know, do they have to fetch water every day,
right,
especially for women. Mm-hmm. And then we'll send the water for lab tests. Most of the case, the result will come out with very high level of bacteria, especially E. coli and coliforms.
Right.
And these are bacteria that cause waterborne diseases and can cause death. So so after doing that, we would also, you know, find out more about their lifestyle, whether they practice hand washing, do they have a toilet. Unfortunately, a lot of these villages with water issue has no toilet as well, because even if you have a toilet built by an NGO or government, they will not be able to use it because there's no water to flush them. So open defecation is still widely practiced in this type of communities. Yeah, so upon confirming that the problem is real, the water is contaminated, we would then propose to them, we'll propose a few things. Number one, we'll provide every household with a water filter. And Westergaard is a company who design rural use a water filter, and that's a Life Straw Home 2.0 that we use, a filter
mm-hmm.
that is catered for household use. So we'll tell them, we'll show them the water filter, and we explain to them how this water filter can get rid of the bacteria and harmful germs, and as well as dirt in the water. Most of them would be very happy to want to have one at home. The other proposal that we'll usually suggest is to bring water more accessible to them. Women typically walk between 200 meters to a kilometer on a daily basis, and sometimes it's multiple trips, because carrying big container of water is very heavy, and so women, you know, go several times a day, and it's very tiring. It can cause injury. Some women are complaining of backache and so on. So we want to make water more accessible to them. So we either propose to them to build a well that's nearer to their community, or if there's no water source and the only water source is a distance away, we'll suggest to them perhaps using piping and a water pump to draw water to a larger tank that is near to the community. Yeah, so we've done that in multiple communities, and they're basically very happy to have water that's very more accessible.
Okay, so it's a very long and tedious process. You mentioned testing the water and gaining the trust of them. So what are the other sustainable solutions that CUP has come up with so far, you know, besides wash training? Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. So wash training is a very important part, providing them with water filter, making water more accessible. Other than that, we actually look into the health and diet. We would ask them what they actually eat in the morning, afternoon and evening. We also observe some families are so poor that their only source of food is ubi kayu, you know, and some wild vegetable that they can collect. So there's seriously lack of protein in a lot of their diet. And on the extreme side, you see obesity among orang asli communities. And when you study their diet, majority of their intake is carbohydrates, is fried, flour and rice and, mm-hmm. and you know, it's all carbs. So we also look into their nutrition, giving them advice about, right. you know, having more protein. They do go out to the river to catch fishes. Mm-hmm. So that's a very good source of protein, and we actually encourage that.
Yeah.
We also found villages that has access to electricity, and they burn the palm seeds, the palm fruits, the dried palm fruits. They burn them at night in a bowl to lead up like a bonfire to get light. And it produces a lot of smoke. It's very warm. So we also look into that, and we've started to roll out initiative to give some of the houses with solar lights, simple solar lights that would able to give them, you know, lighting that they can be productive at night. Women told us that, you know, even to do cooking, they have to do before sunset because it's a bit risky to cut, you know, their food using yeah. knife with a very dim light mm-hmm. and so on.
Yeah.
So helping, giving the family, you know, time to be productive in the evening with proper lighting actually make a big change to their life as well.
Mm-hmm. So some of the initiatives go just beyond access to clean water and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Because we when community faces poverty, it's usually a multi-dimensional factors and mm-hmm. issues. So it's involved water, electricity and nutrition, and then education also come in, where it's a lot of kids that drop out. There are villages that has very little very few kids who actually attend school. Yeah.
I see. Has CUP ever collaborated with any governmental ministries?
Yeah. So we have discussion with Ministry of Education about how do we address some of the issues that the Orang Asli children face going to school.
Mm-hmm.
The cultural differences, you know, going to school, some of these kids could not adapt or integrate with other students. Looking into their transportation issue, which is actually one of the big challenge we look at it for communities that are, you know, that has no proper road system because they live near the plantation or inside the plantations. And So we have discussion with Ministry of Health on nutrition issue. We also met with the state level Department of Orang Asli
right.
To talk about some of the observations that we saw. Yeah. So our hope is that we can address these challenges in a collective manner, because there's no one organization alone can actually solve all the issues.
I see. So we're going to take a short break now, but when we come back, we'll be looking at the communities that are affected the most by the lack of access to clean water. I'm speaking to Dr. Tay Soo Tai, CEO of the Global Peace Foundation Malaysia, and we're talking about their flagship program, Communities Unite for Pure Water, and their work in providing access to clean water in Malaysia. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Kelly Anissa. Joining me on the show today is Dr. Tay Soo Tai, the CEO of Global Peace Foundation Malaysia. We're talking about one of their flagship programs, Communities Unite for Pure Water, or better known as CUP, and we're discussing access to clean water for Malaysians. Now, Dr. Tay, 1 in 9 people lack access to safe water. Do we have any stats and figures to paint a clearer picture of the overall situation here in Malaysia?
Well, according to our Water, Land and Natural Resources Minister, Dr. Xavier Jayakumar, about 3% of Malaysia's population do not have access to clean water. And majority of them live in the interior of Kelantan, Sabah and Sarawak.
Why these states in particular? And earlier you also mentioned Pahang, yeah. right? You do a lot yeah. of work in Pahang. So why these states in particular?
Yeah. Well, I suppose geographically, when these communities are located very remotely, especially, you know, if you want to access to these villages going through mountains, rivers, crossing rivers, it gets very difficult to build water infrastructure for them. Other than that, it could also be related to how much resources state government, how much it actually invests into building water resource, water infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, and you mentioned the Orang Asli a few times. Why are their communities the most affected by this issue?
Yeah. So, as we all know, Orang Asli, for years, their ancestors live within the forest, or where they actually get access to forest resources, mm-hmm. To survive. And so Orang Asli used to be able to tap onto cleaner water of running stream from the hill or mountain or in the jungle. But as we observe, a lot of the Orang Asli today has been displaced. They move out from where they used to live because of deforestation or because of plantations. Mm-hmm. So the communities that we are working with, majority of them are living at the edge of the plantation or within plantations. And so when they live in the plantations, most of them do not have access to running stream. And they have very little options in terms of water source. Mm-hmm. And due to that, they have to either build a well or get any water from stagnant surface water. We call them surface water. Mm-hmm. And commonly, this type of water are contaminated.
Right.
Contaminated because of logging activities, animal activities, and they're exposed. Water source is actually exposed, not treated. So that's just why the health effects comes in and affect many of them.
I see. So between 2003 to 2007, the Orang Asli infant mortality rate was double the national figure. And the prevalence and the intensity of parasitic infections was high. I think it was up to 90% in some of these communities. And it's been, 12 years since we've seen those numbers. So what are the numbers like today? Are we seeing any improvements at all?
I do not have the latest figure, but I believe the figure is still high. It will be always higher than our other Malaysian population, as long as the issue with access to clean water is not resolved. As I mentioned earlier, and our observations has proven that when a community has lack of access to clean water, the hygienic practices will be ignored because they will not waste the water. You know, we can use the word waste. When they have to fetch water carrying, using a hand and walk very far away and coming back to home with two buckets of water that they're going to use for cooking, for drinking, and a bit of, washing their dishes, most of them would not use the water to wash their house. We live in some of those village for a while to understand the lifestyle. So they do not clean their house so much, and they don't have hand washing practices. Brushing teeth is also very, very uncommon. And some of them also shower less. So all of this actually affects their personal hygiene. Mm-hmm. And the effects of that is we see a lot of skin rashes. Health is quite bad. Last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. we were in Pahang. So we do a monthly trip. So we stay in that region for the whole week.
Right.
And we'll be visiting village after village. So within that week alone, two women of the community that we work with, two women in their 50s, mm-hmm. passed away. And of course, the villagers would not be able to explain why they passed. But as we observe, the health level of the Orang Asli community is quite bad. We hear stories of people in their 50s, one of the elder, who say he was sick for 1 month, just lying, on the bed, cannot really walk, very weak. And he just recovered. And we also you know, hear mother who say the son was admitted twice to hospital because of vomiting and diarrhea. We've seen kids' mother asking us, you know, what's the sickness of their kids, because that little boy was down with fever, very weak when we were there. Yeah, right. So we've seen a lot of health issues in these communities.
Yeah. I see. So Dr. Xavier Jayakumar also stated that we have failed in educating the masses about water conservation. He said that in order to preserve water, we must learn how to conserve water, and that this can only be done through education in schools. Do you agree with this? Is it the lack of education the cause of the problem?
I think when we have free access, you know, water is freely accessed to us. Naturally, people, you know, living with water pipes and abundant of water, we are not so aware of how precious water is, and people can develop a lifestyle of just simply using water. And you know, when you look at the bills compared to your, let's say, electricity bill, it's way smaller.
Yeah.
So people can you know, adopt a habit of just simply using water, and you know, you don't close the tap when you're brushing teeth and so on. So there has to be an awareness. We also did collaborate with some of our sponsor to create some awareness of, you know, how there are still people in Malaysia, we're not talking about Africa or Cambodia,
right,
that are struggling with water, access to water day in and day out. And I think that helps us, you know, city folks to reflect on our practices on water, that, hey, you know, we're so lucky and we're so blessed, and let's not just simply use or waste, you know, any water. Yeah.
What are the other main causes behind this lack of access to clean water, just, you know, besides the lack of awareness behind it, as Dr. Xavier Jayakumar said?
For the Orang Asli communities that we work with, government is actually trying to also provide infrastructure to this community. We spoke to some of the Orang Asli community. They were being asked to move to join a bigger Orang Asli community where proper infrastructures are provided, especially with water and electricity. And some of the reasons these communities told us why they decided not to move out of where they stay right now to join a bigger community is that their life has been very dependent to farming now. Because of deforestation, there are less and less forest that they can get natural resources, you know, especially this community that we work with. So a lot, so many of these families are actually farmers, mm-hmm. And they plant what they consume. So if they actually move out to a community with better infrastructure, but has no land for them to do farming, their livelihood will be affected seriously. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we also realize that there is a challenge that I think government need to study further of why these communities have decided to stay where they are, even though they are being invited or recommended to move. Yeah.
And how does the lack of access to clean water affect education in particular? Yeah.
So the lack of access to clean water affects health in particular, and it also affects the mothers. And the way how it affects mothers is mothers now have to work harder. They have to spend time going out to fetch water in the morning and in the afternoon. And as I mentioned earlier, mothers has been telling us they get backache, they sometimes get muscle injury. Coupling the factor of mothers having to spend time fetching water, less time with the kids, and children's health affected. So both of these factors affect education. Some of those mothers actually also responsible to fetch their kids to school. There's a mother in particular who told us that she's to use her own motorbike because there's no transportation provided for that particular village. Many of the kids in the village already drop out from school, but she insisted that education is important. So despite having to spend time fetching water, cooking, and doing other house chores, she has to send her kids to the school.
Right.
Yeah. And when other mothers would probably already given up because it's just too many things to handle for them. The other aspect is when kids get sick because of waterborne diseases, they get diarrhea, they get fever, they will then not attend school. And a lot of these kids already face challenges in the school, not able to cope out academically, not integrating with other kids, feeling a bit of inferior or being bullied, you know, being called right. names. Already other challenges are there. And if they get sick, then the attendance rate will even be lower. Yes, and that essentially affected their education.
You mentioned that women are affected by the water crisis the most in this situation. And it's because, as you mentioned, they have to go and collect the water. And of course, it does affect their health as well. And, you know, maybe you can elaborate more on how the water crisis is also a health crisis for everyone.
Yeah. So water is such a essential part of our life, whether we realize it or not. You know, with a day without water, we would not, you know, be able to survive. So for this community, with lack of access to clean water, the two aspects, as I mentioned, the accessibility, whether the water source is very far, and that equal to time going to fetch water and the physical burden to carry water, and that affects health. The other aspect that we notice among the Orang Asli communities, I've spoken to a young Orang Asli gentleman who is actually a farmer, our last trip 2 weeks ago, and we were talking about the lifestyle of the Orang Asli, and this gentleman has gone out to places like KL and Malacca to work out of his own initiative. It's actually quite rare in the area that we're working with. Mm-hmm. He took his own initiative to work outside of his community. And when he came back, there's one observation he realized that, and that observation is the Orang Asli people in his communities and surrounding, they drink much lesser water.
Right.
Compared to people, you know, outside of the community.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that he suspect that's probably a reason why they get sick very often. Life expectancy is much shorter, that's right. according to research.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the water consumption, when the water that you have, it's a bit muddy, the taste doesn't taste that good, it's less likely that you have a desire to drink a lot of it. And Orang Asli being nowadays, many of them being farmers, they go out to the farm, they don't carry water bottle like we do. And they you know, they can be out there for many hours without drinking. So that, for long term, I think it affects, you know, their health as a general, it affects their immune system and so on. And of course, the most serious issues related to access to clean water is waterborne diseases. When water is contaminated, it causes cholera, typhoid fever, hepatitis A, leptospirosis. Leptospirosis is surprisingly, quite common in Malaysia, and they're caused by water that's contaminated with rat's urine.
Right.
Yeah, and we've heard Orang Asli people who actually been admitted to hospital because of that as well.
And do we have any statistics as to how many people die each year in Malaysia who are exposed to water-related diseases? You know, especially those that where it's due to their poverty, for example.
Yeah. So Based on our research, statistics from the Ministry of Health website, we actually found a data on waterborne diseases such as typhoid fever, cholera, leptospirosis, and so on. And the data is from 2015 that we got. About 9,000 cases reported of these waterborne diseases, and out of 9,000 of incidents, there are about 90 cases of mortality. Wow. Yeah. So the fact is, waterborne diseases are very preventable if the access to clean water is available, and hygienic practices are being taught, you know, to this type of community.
So out of the 90 cases that you mentioned, I'm assuming that most of them are Orang Asli, from Orang Asli communities?
We don't have the data. There's no segmentization of the data.
I see. Mm. So what approach can we take to implement better policies in place to ensure access to clean water for everyone?
Yeah. I think we all know that it's technically very challenging and very costly to use conventional or way of building water pipings to this type of communities that are remotely located. So I think there has to be more innovative approaches. If the conventional way of building water pipe doesn't work or is costing too much, then let's look at other ways. How can we build wells that are cleaner? How do we provide water filters that are effective in filtering contaminants and you know, harmful bacteria for this community? So that's what we have been trying to do the last few years. Going to the community, identify the water source, and look at what technology is affordable and can provide better access, water source get closer to them, and a cleaner and safer water. Yeah, so I believe a lot of different approaches can be utilized. In Sarawak, where we have work at, we also use rain harvesting system because the rainfall in Sarawak is much higher.
Right.
So rain harvesting system works quite well. And of course, rainwater is not the cleanest. You will still need to provide them with filters. Yeah, and I know that Ministry of Health has done a lot of good work by providing those community who live near to the hill, meaning that there is running stream from the hill, with piping, and the system is called gravity feed.
Okay.
So basically tapping into stream water up in a hill that is much cleaner than just digging the ground for water.
So how can more people get involved with the initiatives that CUP does?
Yeah. So we are constantly looking for partners and sponsors as well as volunteers. Because we know there are still many communities out there, many villages out there that are still struggling with the issues of lack of access to clean water, sanitation, you know, and hygiene. So this work has to continue. Every time when we go to a new village, it will tell us, why don't you come to my relative's village? They need the same help. So we really welcome anyone or any organization who are keen to work together with us to magnify the impact and the benefit to those communities.
I see. Well, thank you for coming on the show today, Doctor. I've been speaking to Dr. Tay Soo Tai, the CEO of Global Peace Foundation Malaysia. We were discussing one of their flagship programs, Communities Unite for Pure Water, that has been working to provide access to clean water to rural communities in Malaysia. If you've missed any part of this interview or any Live and Learn segments, you can download the podcast on the BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.